In a new book called Bronx Faces and Voices, 16 people tell their personal uncensored stories of what happened before, during, and after the troubled years of urban decay, crime, arson, and abandonment that plagued their borough. The book features firsthand accounts by community organizers, religious leaders, entrepreneurs, and politicians, along with photographs by Georgine Comerford and Walter Rosenblum. It's published by Texas Tech University Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings co-editor Amita Brady Hill, a professor and former chancellor of Indiana University, Kokomo, to our show, along with former community organizer Susan Boyd. Welcome.
Thank you, Leonard.
Thank you.
Amita, you wrote that you would have wanted to call this book Profiles in Courage if the name hadn't already been taken. What's courageous about the people and the stories that you've collected here?
The people in the book didn't leave when the going got tough. So many people left the Bronx, whether they went to Co-op City, they went to Florida, they went somewhere along Island. And these people, some of whom had come in the 20s, some had come in the 40s, 50s, they stayed through the worst time. They could describe it to me. They organized, they created community organizations, and they were not leaving. I found this very brave of them.
In the foreword, former borough president Fernando Ferrer says that the Bronx has an almost Shakespearean past. Is he talking about the comedies or the tragedies?
Freddie never explained that particular line to me, but there was both. There were wonderful reunions. He and I startled each other once by showing up at the same birthday party of one of the more exotic people in my book, and he simply looked at me and said, "What are you doing here?" We had fun.
Did the oral history project that this comes out of begin as part of your research when you were a professor at Lehman College in the 80s?
Absolutely not. My field is 18th century French literature. I was there during the fiscal crisis, during the 70s, and when the universities were hurting, the communities were hurting, and I'd been in the Bronx long enough to feel bonded with it, if you will. And the NEH, that great mother in the sky, gave me a big grant to do oral histories, along with many other people, to document the stories of that time.
But it is a bit odd that this book about the Bronx is co-edited by a professor at an Indiana university, published by a university press from Texas.
That is unusual, and I admire the University of Texas Press for having taken us on, Texas Tech.
Susan, since we're talking about people being everywhere, we're talking to you from Florida. Aren't you from Massachusetts? How did you come to live and work in the South Bronx?
I went to the South Bronx in order to go to Fordham University as a graduate student. And I was living in the South Bronx and didn't actually realize it very much. But I got to know my neighbors very well, and that's how I became involved in what was going on in their neighborhoods, in the deterioration, how they were reacting to it. And I decided that maybe that would be a more important thing for me to be involved in.
And that began around 1969, 1970 or so.
Yes.
The neighborhood was already in dire straits?
It was beginning to be that way, yes. I know that the university was concerned about what was happening. I know the Bronx Zoo was concerned because one of its entrances was at West Farms, which was beginning to deteriorate. So, yes, and then it happened very rapidly over the next few years.
You first worked for the Tremont Community Corporation and said that they had some problems, but that the community was still a pretty viable area. What problems was the agency facing?
Well, there was a lot of competition. There was problems with its leadership and how it was being run. The whole idea behind the community corporations, which I firmly believed in, was to create leadership out of the community itself. And that doesn't happen overnight. So people were being hired that may not have had a lot of experience. They had a lot of learning to do, and so mistakes would get made. Maybe it wouldn't be as efficient as it should have been. But little by little, they began to learn and became a very powerful force in the community and used the government funds, I think, in a tremendous way, which was by building community and local leadership.
Amita, your students at Lehman College were mostly from the Bronx. How did that affect the stories that they collected?
Most of the interviews were not done by students. They were done by faculty, people with a fair bit of training in oral history. But we encouraged faculty to incorporate oral history into their courses and have their students interview their grandparents. There are about 450 hours of interviews in the Lehman archives, in the Bronx archives, in the Leonard Leaf Library at Lehman. So it's a tremendous resource for scholars who have come and dug through it. But no one, to my knowledge, except me, has yet taken the integral stories and put them out to share with other people. This
and
is what I wanted to do.
You had to winnow it down to 16.
I only did 30 myself, and of the 30 I did, I chose these 16 just because to me they're the most compelling stories. I'm a storyteller, I'm a literary person, and to me they were the most. The others are good, but these were compelling.
One of them is from Irving Bick, a successful small businessman who had moved to the Bronx with his immigrant parents in the 1920s, and he said he got chills during the horrible experience of visiting his old neighborhood. Was this feeling shared by many of the other older residents that you spoke to?
Very much so. And Irving was one of the oldest of the ones whom I interviewed. And in fact, Leonard, I talked to his wife just a couple of weeks before the big reunion last week celebrating the book, and he just died on November 18th, very sadly. But he also had wonderfully positive memories of his childhood, and when he did end his story, he was excited that Charlotte Gardens was going to go up, hadn't yet gone up, but he thought his neighborhood would be coming back.
Well, Susan, was Jimmy Carter's visit to Charlotte Street a positive moment in the story?
You know, I remember that. Though it wasn't the area that I was in, and I was working a little bit north there in the Tremont area, but I do remember his coming to Charlotte Street, and we were very happy that a president was coming to see for himself the dire consequences of neglect and economic problems in the Bronx. And so it was a hopeful note for us. Though I can remember we were also a little bit cynical about it as well, wondering if anything really would come of it.
And was that cynicism realistic?
In some ways, yes, because if you read in the oral history that I did, for example, trying to keep our institutions, which kept our neighborhoods together, one being Fordham Hospital, they just wanted to come in and tear the heart out of many of these neighborhood institutions, regardless of how the community felt about it. So there was the positive side, and then there was the negative side. What I liked mostly about the community corporations and the way they worked is that they did empower local people more than any other programs I had ever seen. And we really kind of became a force to reckon with throughout the city, particularly going down to the Board of Estimate and talking to the mayor and trying to get things done. We were training people how to do that on their own. And I think that scared many city officials.
What was happening to Fordham Hospital at this time? You say that it went from being one of the dingiest places to one of the finest emergency care places, but that the city was still determined to close it.
Well, we think that, and it was. It became a fabulous place. Even the police, as I mentioned, that was the place that they wanted to go because we had full-time doctors taking care of the emergency room. It was a loving and caring place. It had translators for every language that you can imagine. And a lot of this was done by the community hospital board that community members were a part of.
Why was the city targeting Fordham Hospital then?
Well, we think it got targeted. I mean, because Montefiore wanted to build the hospital next to their facility. They wanted a city facility, and they couldn't do both. So the politics and the powers that be were able to get the city money to build North Central Bronx Hospital and tear down Fordham. Fordham had already gone through its whole design. It was almost ready to go into the ground when they stopped it.
Amita, you write that Susan was able to effectively work the press. In what way?
Well, Susan describes in her story people being there from the different media and saying to her, we are going to cover this when it was something that, or we're not going to cover something that was detrimental. But she also said that they did their best when they took over, when they shut down the Cross Bronx, the parade, couldn't get media coverage, couldn't get themselves jailed because the police had been told to leave them alone. They didn't want that kind of attention. So sometimes Susan was able to work it, and sometimes she couldn't make it happen.
Susan, you became very involved with the Twin Parks development. What was that?
Twin Parks was building...
Not Twin Peaks, right? Twin Parks?
No, not Twin Peaks. Twin Parks, based on Bronx Park and Crotona Park. So the area in between that, which is basically centered around 180th Street, was a program to redevelop many of the to build new buildings, new housing for low-income people, but also to rehabilitate the housing in between, and also to do what's called vest pocket housing. So if one or two small lots had become vacant, they would just build smaller buildings there to try to integrate them into the neighborhood.
And
so
you
it was
said
a
that
really great plan.
You said the community wanted low-rise apartments, which
yes.
would have been more manageable. But who was insisting on building high-rises?
Usually the federal government.
And you say you witnessed a fair amount of abuse of power and political corruption on the planning board?
Well, that sort of happened after I left, so a lot of that was hearsay. But it turned out that building some of these, the way that it worked, the financing worked for these buildings, you could, if you knew what you were doing, get quite a bit of money by the sale of the equity. And a lot of community organizations were beginning to get involved in that and understand how it worked, and therefore there was competition as to whose ideas and whose plans would actually come to fruition and who would actually end up with the money from the federal government.
Amita, you spoke to some of the movers and shakers who had, in many cases, had very positive impact on the Bronx. You interviewed Irma Fleck, the driving force behind the Bronx Museum, Mario Biaggi, who was an ardent supporter of bilingual programs, and even Stanley Friedman, the man who wound up spending some time in jail for racketeering, conspiracy, and mail fraud.
That's true. That happened after I interviewed him. In fact, a number of the people in my book had some problems later on in life, but at the time...
Were you aware that he was under a cloud?
Not at that time. Not at the time I interviewed him. He wasn't at that time. And his interview, in fact, is a very charming one. It goes back to, he's the only one who goes back to the early goat farms and the memories of that. But he also spoke about his own role, aware already that he probably wasn't going to run for public office. He didn't want that kind of exposure, but that he was not quite the power behind the throne, but the distributor of patronage and helped other people. He promoted the careers of a number of other politicians. He had a pretty accurate sense of self at that time. But some of the others, Mike Nunez was a real force for change. And as Susan was saying the other day, he really rebuilt a lot of the Bronx one factory at a time as he invested in it and went beyond anti-poverty funding and grants to really start getting the Bronx to invest in itself and get money from the banks and rebuild.
Susan, go ahead.
I was going to say, if I could interject for a minute, because I've been doing a lot of thinking about this, obviously, lately, and it just seemed to me, you know, our politicians were very receptive to us. It seems like it was a different era, in a way. All the politicians that were affected or their constituencies were affected by the closing of Fordham Hospital were extraordinarily helpful to us. An example would be, we didn't win in the end, but I'm not sure exactly what the political power needed to be in order to win our fight. But I will say that the politicians that we asked for help gave it and gave a lot. And they were very approachable, extremely approachable.
Abrams also talked about he worked with you on Fordham Hospital. He also worked with Lehman College during the years that total construction project was shut down. He worked with the president and helped get that back on the move.
Has the area recovered from the shutdown of Fordham Hospital?
Well, I went driving the other day all around the places that I knew, and it's looking pretty good. It's looking pretty good.
Well, just in time for Bronx's centennial.
Yes.
Bronx, I didn't realize that the Bronx is only 100 years old. All the other boroughs are a lot older. But it still has areas of extreme poverty.
But that's when it became the last county of New York City. That's mm-hmm. what the centennial is. It became the 62nd county. It was around before that, but it hadn't been dignified as a county.
How has gentrification affected residents who have lived in these neighborhoods for years?
I'm not so sure there is a lot of gentrification. It's not something that it's not a kind of gentrification that you're getting, for example, in Brooklyn and perhaps Queens. And I was talking to a friend of mine who is a longtime Bronx resident and owns a house in the Bronx, and who also were involved with me, John and Faith DeVoe. And they kind of observed that the Bronx doesn't have those beautiful brownstones and those kind of gorgeous neighborhoods that gentrification tends towards. And so it doesn't have a huge, gigantic gentrification movement. And even just this past month, the Smithsonian did a major article on the Bronx and called it the invisible borough, just this past month. So the Bronx has a problem when it comes to people understanding it and wanting to come and live in it in terms of gentrification.
And yet it has some wonderful places, not just the zoo and the botanic gardens, but also the Grand Concourse, a number of major boulevards and some beautiful housing.
Yes.
A lot of that is being bought up, and I mean, there've been a number of articles on how the cost, the sale prices of these condos is going up, and areas of the Bronx are coming back more quickly than others. But it's true, there aren't that many individual houses unless you go to Throgs Neck or Kingsbridge. Some there are neighborhoods that are, and there are other neighborhoods that will simply take longer. And I'm not sure the industrial parks really helped in terms of bringing back residents and gentrification. But I think some of the images in this book show the beauty of that borough even then. I mean, always, but 30 years ago, when Walter Rosenblum walked those streets taking pictures of faces, the beautiful faces that are in this book, it was a labor of love.
And that was important to include these photos by Walter, and who was, by the way, my photography teacher at Brooklyn College, and also Georgine Comerford. They're quite wonderful. The editors of this book are Amita Brady Hill, who's been our guest, along with Janet Butler Munkt. The book is Bronx Faces and Voices, 16 Stories of Courage and Community. One of those voices was Susan Boyd, and I thank you both for being on our show today.
Thank you, Leonard.
Thank you.